That's true.
We're going to do 2234.
I think some of them don't even have a direct.
I'll open up the committee on house care, on health, the House Committee on Health Care for March 6th. We have a ton of business I want to do today. So let's begin by opening up a work session on House Bill 2234 and invite Representative Wisnett to talk about an amendment we have on this bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, Gene Wisnett, House, State Representative, House District 53. Honorable committee members and chair, we testified on this bill before, and we're still looking for compromise and solutions on how to actually build or how we're going to pay for this. I can report to you that I support Dash 4. A lot of effort by lobbyists and representatives from the health authority and providers and the actual nonprofit organizations. I had the honor this week of visiting Liberty House, which is the facility in Salem that provides this mm-hmm. care for abused children. You remember the testimony we had before with Senator Gelzer and Representative Barton. They were there with us. We had a great time meeting the staff there. And just to put some faces or some facts on this bill, there are 21 of these organizations throughout Oregon. But they still have to turn away 20 to 30 cases a month. So this bill will help provide them funds to maybe save children's lives. So I hope you'll pass the bill, and thank you very much for doing this.
The amendment does?
What we had to do is try to find out how we actually, who could, was it a bill, a contract, and that we've got that straightened out now. The health authority will do some, and then the providers will, it'll be on a contract basis with the, I believe I'm correct in that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Wisnett.
Any questions, but you're going to have some other people in the back if we get any more specifics, but please pass the bill.
No, we've had a public hearing. We're going to go to work on it.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Greenlick, I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 3/3/15.
Representative Hayden moves that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments, is that?
Dash 4, yes,
dated
sir.
Dated
3/3/15
to the bill. Is there any discussion on that? Is there any objection to that? So moved.
Chair Greenlick, I move House Bill 2234 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves House Bill 2234 as amended with the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Bueller?
Representative
Bueller? Bueller, excuse.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Hammer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Barton will carry it on the floor.
And Rep.
Wisnett. And Rep. Wisnett. Co-carries. Great. Excellent. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2234. We're going to do some work sessions first today. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2825 for the purpose of moving the bill on to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Nose.
Mr. Chair, just a minute. I lost my place. Okay, I found it.
Mm-mm.
No.
You need to adopt the amendments. That's what it's for.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 20, 2015.
Representative Nose moves we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2/20/15 to House Bill 2825. Is there any discussion? What does that amendment do, Madam Administrator?
First of all, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2825 was requiring the Oregon Health Authority to seek out and apply for grants, contributions, and or gifts, and appropriate the money from general fund to pay for crisis intervention services and residential care for individuals with mental health. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So the Dash 2 allows the health authority to seek out and apply for funding, and it also clarifies that the community-based housing for these individuals also include addictions and co-occurring disorders, and it also specifies some funding allocation. It breaks up the proportion of startup money. And I will also review the Dash 3s, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The Dash 3s add that the bill also established a work group, an advisory work group, to help with the determination of issuing the funds through the grants. It's adding an acute psychiatric unit representative, a psychiatric unit from a community hospital as a representative on the workforce or the work group.
Great.
About the bill as you move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you.
How?
Currently, charters, if you could address yourself.
I'm sorry.
Recognize yourself for the record, please.
Portland Public Schools.
Thank you.
We have another room.
Currently.
Wow.
And there was a motion on for the Dash 2s, correct?
So far, that's the only one, yes.
Is there any discussion on the motion on the Dash 2 amendment? Any objection? Dash 2 is added. We have a Dash 3 now?
We do, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment dated February 24, 2015.
Representative Notes moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 2-24-15 to House Bill 2825. Is there any discussion on that amendment? So moved. We have a motion on the bill now?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2825 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Nose moves HB 2825 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it as amended and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please take the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noth?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. The motion carries, and House Bill 2825 is on its way to the Committee on Ways and Means. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I have the right language, but I'm wondering if you can open up a work session on House Bill. Suspend the rules for House Bill 2234 so that Representative Buehler can vote.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves we suspend the rules so that to allow Representative Buehler to vote on House Bill 2234. Hearing no objection, how do you vote, Representative?
Yes, Chair.
Do I have to open that work session to do that?
No, you did that when you accepted the motion.
Okay. I'll close that motion again, that work session again, and open up a work session on House Bill 20. No, which one?
Well, Mr. Chair, we got a late amendment. It didn't get posted until 12:36. Therefore, we need to wait an hour before we can look at the 2541.
I think we won't open this bill at all today. We'll plan on rescheduling it for about Wednesday.
Okay.
I'll move on to House Bill 2560. And what do we have on House Bill 25? I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2560. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2560 requires that health benefit plans to cover the cost of a colonoscopy for an insured who is 50 years of age or older and who has had positive fecal immunochemical test results, directs the insurers to include the removal of polyps during a colonoscopy. Mr. Chair, we have the Dash 2, the Dash 3, and the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay, I need to make a statement first on this. I've been in communication with the insurance division on this and on perhaps the bill that we passed before. This bill may create a mandate to do what we're proposing here, and therefore it may trigger an ACA discussion about whether that mandate increases the cost that the state would have to pick up rather than being picked up in the exchange, in the subsidized exchange. It turns out that it is clear that this bill would not increase costs, but would reduce costs to health insurance, and therefore, while it still might be a mandate and would need to be ruled on, the insurance commissioner has given us an indeterminate fiscal on it, and has no objection to us moving it forward under the assumption that if they figure out how to deal with mandates, which they haven't quite figured out how to do yet, they'll assess whether this was an increase or a decrease in the cost. So we are free to move ahead, and we have the paper on the amendments on this one.
Yes, we do.
So okay. What do we got?
Well, we have the Dash 2 amendments.
Which does?
I don't know by... Oh, the Dash 2 amendments is a technical amendment that we're clearly specifying that it excludes health savings accounts from the coverage of this directive. The Dash 3s establishes an implementation date of January 1, 2017. The Dash 4s specify that any positive fecal test with a specified grade being A or B by the task force has a follow-up colonoscopy. So they're all relatively technical in nature.
And we ended up with no opposition to the bill with those amendments.
Not to my knowledge, Mr. Chair.
Can we have some motions, please?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt Dash 2 amendment dated 3-13-15. Can I do it all in one? 2-13-15. I also move to adopt Dash... I can just do one at a time?
One at a time.
Okay. Representative Hayden moves we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2-13-15 to the House Bill 2560. Is there any objection to that? Any discussion? So moved. Representative Hayden?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt Dash 3 amendment on February 24th, 2015.
February 24th? Representative Hayden moves the Dash 3 amendments dated 2-24-15, the House Bill 2560. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt Dash 4 amendment dated February 27, 2015.
Representative Hayden moves we adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 2-27-15, the House Bill 2560. Any discussion on that motion? Any objection? So moved. Representative Hayden, you got the floor again.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt... Mr. Chair, I move HB 2560 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves HB 2560 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would just like to bring to the record that I'm glad that I don't have to declare a potential conflict of interest on this bill because I am not 50 years old yet.
It is my hope that over the life of the bill, you will actually get to 50. But be careful.
Would you remind us all to be nice, including me?
Is there any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem? Aye. Representative Kenimer? Aye. Representative Kenny Geyer? Aye. Representative Weidner? Aye. Vice Chair Hayden? Aye. Vice Chair Noakes? Aye. Chair Greenlight? Aye. Motion carries. HB 2560 is on its way to the floor with the best recommendation, and I'll carry it. Close the work session, and House Bill 2560. And that's... Let's see, where are we going now? Let's open a work session on House Bill 2307. Sandy, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2307 had a public hearing on February 23rd. It prohibits mental and social health providers from providing any service to an individual under 18 years of age for the purpose of attempting to change the individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. Declares an emergency effective on passage. We have the Dash 5 amendments. The Dash 5 amendments replace the phrase sexual orientation with conversion therapy terminology, and it also specifies that the prohibition is for professional services only.
Representative Noakes, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 5 amendment for 2307 dated March 2nd, 2015.
Representative Notes moves the Dash 5 amendments be added to House Bill 2307, dated 3-2-15. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would like to thank Representative Noth for working with Representative Stark on these amendments and everything, and appreciate his cooperation on it.
Great, thank you. Is there any other discussion on the Dash 5 amendments? Is there any objection? Dash 5 amendments are added to House Bill 2307. Representative Noth, do you have a...
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House Bill 2307, as amended, be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Notes moves that House Bill 2307 be moved to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask that we hold this bill over for a little later vote, and I'm sorry to do that, but you'll recall that in the discussion that we had, the question was raised about whether those existing licensing boards would already not consider that. I said that in the negative. Let me try to say that. That the licensing boards would not consider that as appropriate professional conduct, and therefore, yeah. And I asked that question. I talked to a lobbyist who was operating on the bill and was promised that I would get a response from each of the licensing boards, talked to that person today, and that has not yet been accomplished. I would like to know whether or not this is an allowed practice under the current license for these licenses before voting on the bill.
Why don't we move the bill till Monday?
Hopefully that will be enough time, and I appreciate that, and I think the view was that this person would expedite it, and I appreciated that.
Representative Notes, if you're okay with that solution, would you please take the motion off the table?
I'd rather move the bill today. Mr. Chair, I will withdraw the motion to move the bill and delay till Monday.
Okay, we'll carry this over until Monday, Madam Administrator.
Hmm? Thank you. And Representative Wider had his hand up.
Yes, Representative Wider.
It's actually covered with Representative Kinnemer. I support what he's after because there's still a lot of questions out there for me that I'm still chasing down and everything. And if we actually did move it today, I would be a no vote on it. But I still have – I'm talking actually with Legislative Council. I've been communicating with them and getting information from them, and we're still going back and forth on different issues.
Okay. Try and get to yes by Monday. We'll make the first order of business on Monday.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Before we vote, I just know to Representative Kinnemer's concern, we are trying – I'm trying to help the – one of these lobbyists that's working on this. We're having a little difficulty tracking down people from the board, and we may not be able to accomplish it even by Monday just because some of these boards are a little short-staffed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I am aware of that. On the other hand, I think, at least for me, it is an important part of my decision about what the professional standards are.
We'll hold it till Monday.
Thank you very much.
Close the work session on House Bill 2307. I think that, does that end the work sessions?
That until 1:36.
Until what?
Until 1:36.
And what can we do at 1:36?
At 1:36, we'll be doing... Oh, I apologize. No. The 1:36 we rescheduled off. I apologize. And yes, our work sessions are done.
And we can't do 2600 until 2 o'clock, is that right?
Correct.
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2930. What do we have on House Bill 2930?
Which one? 2930.
Madam Administrator, what have we got here?
Always.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2930. Is requiring hospitals to adopt rules granting admitting privileges to nurse, midwife, nurse practitioners, prohibits hospitals from requiring licensed NMNPs to co-admit patients with physicians who have admitting privileges and prohibits healthcare facilities from denying voting rights of medical staff to the nurse practitioner who is granted admitting privileges at that facility. And we have Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. Alyssa Kenny Geyer, House District 46, Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm really honored to carry this bill. Those of you who served on this committee before know that I worked a lot with the direct entry midwives previously, and some of the certified nurse midwives served on the committee that was looking at really making sure that we had strong choice and access and quality in maternal prenatal care and delivery through the direct entry midwives. And I feel equally passionate about making sure that we have that through the certified nurse midwives. This bill aims to, first and foremost, extend a best practice that's used in many of our hospitals that allows independent admitting for privileges for certified nurse midwives, and they will come up and tell you why that's important. And in addition to that, allow them as medical staff voting privileges, they or anyone in advanced practice nursing who are have independent admitting privileges to have both voting rights on the medical staff committees as well, so that they can share their perspective from the distinct part of the profession that they practice, as well as appeal process that all other, just to clarify that anyone on a medical staff would have that appeal process. It makes sure, clarifies that that's extended to them as well. So they have done a tremendous amount of work and have connected with many of the different organizations that you would expect them to connect with. Hospitals, OMA, ONA, and others. I think there'll be an amendment that we're expecting, and I will let them address that.
Thank you. Any questions? You're going to hang out while we have another witness?
I'm happy to hang out.
Sarah Wickenhagen and Laura Jensen.
Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Wickenhagen. I'm the Advanced Practice Policy Analyst at the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Thank you for this opportunity. I believe that you have my written testimony in front of you. I am an advanced practice nurse who at one time has also had admitting privileges. I would like to let this group know the importance of this ability and capability to ensure patient safety. And I have seen the differences in this ability with advanced practice nurses, in particular certified nurse midwives who have not had this ability, and how it has been a detriment. I would like to urge this committee to consider that they are absolutely within scope and have expert medical care. And I have seen when nurse practitioners and nurse midwives have had this ability and how it has been seamless, efficient, and provided incredible patient safety and opportunity for our patients in Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee has on my behalf. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the House Committee on Healthcare, for the record, my name is Laura Jensen, and I live in Southeast Portland, Oregon. I am a certified nurse midwife and a nurse midwife nurse practitioner here in the state of Oregon. And quickly, to explain what a certified nurse midwife is, I'm a registered nurse. I have a master's degree from an accredited graduate school, and I'm certified nationally by the American Midwifery Certification Board and of Passport Exams. In Oregon, in 2013, nurse midwives attended 18% of all births in the state. 96% of those births occurred in a hospital setting. And this is why this hospital privileging bill is critical, because limitations on access to hospitals effectively prevent nurse midwives from being able to practice what we're trained to do. The bill aims to increase access to healthcare for women. It aims to ensure continuity of care. And also the bill will hopefully decrease liability for our physician colleagues. As Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned, it has three main parts. One is that nurse midwives who are accepted to practice in a hospital setting will have admitting privileges. Secondly, that they'll have membership on medical staff with voting rights, and thirdly, that all that due process and the credentialing application and disciplinary processes is fair and transparent. The changes in House Bill 2930, they won't be new for some hospitals, including the one for which I work. I have admitting privileges, and this is a common practice at OHSU where I care for women, for advanced practice nurses. I'm on medical staff. I have voting rights, and my application credentialing and disciplinary processes are transparent and fair. A letter has been submitted in support of the bill, for the record, by physician Mike Bonazzola, and he's the chair of the Credentials Committee at OHSU and the Oregon chapter of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is in support of the bill. They've submitted a letter. And at a national level, ACOG supports the bill. My own professional organization, the American College of Nurse Midwives, has also submitted a letter in support of the bill. Federally speaking, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services has written that it encourages medical staff in hospitals to take advantage of the expertise of non-physician practitioners when making recommendations and appointments to the medical staff. And CMS defers to the state law regarding this issue. So really, HB 2930 is consistent with federal bodies' statements on hospital privileging and medical staff membership. And the key issue here is that having access to high-quality, cost-effective care is important for the women and families of Oregon. Midwives have a long tradition of working in underserved areas, including rural areas. Midwives have been shown to have low rates of interventions in labor and birth, with excellent outcomes and high patient satisfaction. And with Medicaid covering over 40% of births in Oregon, having nurse midwifery care available to all women can be an important aspect to help contain costs and ensuring the health and promoting the well-being of Oregon moms and babies. HB 2930 will also help Oregon achieve the triple aim of improving the health of the population, enhancing the experience and the outcome of the patient, and reducing per capita cost of care for the benefit of our Oregon communities.
I routinely vote against anything that aims
to
improve the triple aim.
Sorry. Thank you for your time.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes.
You said the vast majority of the deliveries attended by a nurse midwife happen in the hospital.
Correct.
How does that happen without this bill?
Many hospitals.
What will this bill do to change that?
Thanks for the question. Many hospitals routinely require that nurse midwives have a co-signature on their admit orders by a physician colleague. Many times, that physician never has any contact with the patient, and the nurse midwife independently admits, cares for in labor and delivery, and discharges her postpartum. And at some point in time in the system, a physician has to put his or her name on the record. That in itself puts that obstetrician at greater or increased risk for liability.
Thank you.
Kenemer has a question.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated your sharing your credentials with us, and I guess, does the bill require that all certified nurse midwives have equivalent credentials?
Thanks for that question. All certified nurse midwives in the state of Oregon have master's degrees?
That was really what the question was. Excuse me for interrupting, but yeah, that stuck in my mind, and I just wanted to make sure.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Basically, the equivalent of nurse practitioners or advanced practice nurses, they just specialize in this field.
Yeah.
Correct. Some of them have different names.
Yeah.
I'm Sam Buehler.
A couple questions. Chair, thank you.
And we're going to have another witness as well.
Okay, great. Can you tell me the significance of the ACOG statement in support of this?
So thanks for the question. So ACOG on a national level, there is a written statement between ACOG and then the ACNM, which is our professional body, basically reporting that the safety is better when there's seamless care and established relationships between the obstetricians and the nurse midwives. Nurse midwives will always, always have a physician backup because we're not surgeons.
Right.
And so anything that's nobody's practicing renegade midwifery, if you will,
right.
as a profession, our obligation to the safety of our women that we and the families that we care for is to have that close relationship with our obstetrician colleagues.
Okay. More I was driving on just the significance of ACOG to the maybe the rest of the representatives who don't know the organization.
ACOG really drives policy. ACOG is the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And so they are the experts on obstetric and gynecological care. And they have years and years of training, much knowledge, and drive a lot of policy regarding the health of moms and babies.
Health. Mm-hmm. One more. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to add here that, the difference of having a physician's name on admitting privileges versus a physician backup in a hospital is very different. And I think two of the people that I communicated with about this bill were two people that served on the direct entry midwifery task force. One of them is Monica Arce, who's a certified nurse midwife, who doesn't have this at the she works with Virginia Garcia, and at the hospital where she is, she does not have these privileges. So, for instance, if any of the women that she treats want to have a VBAC, that's not allowed at that particular hospital. They have to actually travel 40 minutes away to OHSU. Now, if she had admitting privileges and were on medical staff, she could at least raise it as an issue. It doesn't mean that that gets voted in because she's one voice, but that's where that voice for people that specialize in a particular area of medicine is important to have at the, around the table. But secondly, the other person was Dr. Duncan Nielsen, was also on my committee on midwifery, and he is the head of Women's Health Services. He's the chief OBGYN at Legacy Health Systems, and he runs now all of women's health. He's been in this at Legacy for 35 years. When I told him about this bill and wanted to check it out from a physician's perspective, he was shocked that it wasn't. He said, "We've been doing this for a long time, I think decades." He's like, "Your other hospitals don't do that? It doesn't make any sense at all."
So it's safe to say that ACOG is one of the most definitive sources with regards to women's health in the country.
That's and VBAC is vaginal birth after.
Can you say?
And just to add to what
I think you need to say yes, though, just because we can't. Just so the record.
ACOG, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. And VBAC is vaginal birth after cesarean.
And one final question. How do you handle call burdens? So you have admitting privileges, but also are you taking call for the emergency room? That's always a concern in hospitals, of sharing that burden. So how would that work?
Sure. Thanks for that question. Yeah. Nurse midwives, we don't ever work in the emergency room setting because we're not trained at that level.
I'm sorry, that's not my question. So a woman comes to the... So OBGYNs will have to take call for unassigned patients. So will you also help with that burden?
It depends on the institution. And for example, at OHSU, patients who are maybe considered higher risk, so maybe a patient who just shows up and doesn't have prenatal care established at that institution, they would go to the obstetricians because it's a bit of a higher risk situation. We do take call, and a different, I believe at Kaiser, the midwives will see everybody who comes in the door. Somebody is on call 24/7, physician and two midwives in the case of Sunnyside. And midwives can triage the woman who shows up and then make the determinations about whether it's appropriate for physician care or appropriate for low-risk nurse midwifery care. Does that get at the...
Sharing and call is a hot-button issue.
Yeah, it's pretty... That's controversial in medical staff. So if you have admitting privileges and don't share in the call burden, there's a problem with being fair and equitable. So I want to make sure that that's taken care of in some way, or assured that you're going to help... carry that load, so to speak.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I like to speak to that from the Board of Nursing perspective. It certainly is appropriate that they would be able to participate if asked in the care of obstetrics and gynecology, because that would be their scope of practice. But outside of that, it wouldn't fit for another provider. Also, that was a medical colleague to cover OB call.
Yeah,
if they were asked, they certainly have the capability and scope to do that.
Yeah. Is there some way we could make that transparent in the bill, do you think?
Well, I have a question about that because this is a little out of my realm of practice. But I'm what the bill is trying to do is align it as much as possible with the privileges that other independent admitting privileges. I would think if, in fact, anyone that had admitting privileges was expected to be on call, because I think what you might be asking is not would you be willing to, but could that be a condition?
Yeah.
I'm guessing that that would be, because all of them would be treated the same.
Yeah.
But this really raises a different question, which the next witness I think is going to get to, but each of the hospitals could determine, as they do for admission privileges and other privileges of a physician, I assume the hospitals would be free under this bill to establish those conditions.
Representative.
And if they decide a call was an important piece,
right. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it is sort of a privilege.
Dermatologists mm-hmm. don't always
yeah.
do
it. As long as that's the spirit of the legislation.
Yeah, I think it's the letter of the legislation, or it needs to be.
And to be clear, this is not a scope of practice bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Oh. Yes, Arson Kenimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes we can be slow learners around here. You know, I guess
especially on a Friday afternoon.
what day is this? You know, one of the discussions that we've had around this table a number of times that is a difficult one is another board that's related in topic, and that is the Board of Midwifery. But that's a very distinctly
direct entry midwife.
Thank you for the name change. Yes, a dramatically different group and a dramatically differently trained or. Maybe I'll try to leave it there.
Without hospital privileges.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, and most
clear.
Of them do not have hospital
none
privileges.
Of them. None of them have.
None right. of them. And so, therefore, then none of your members are members of that association as well.
Thank you for the question, Representative Kinnamer. It's
yeah.
the Oregon State Board of Nursing. That's the piece that makes us the nurse, midwife, nurse practitioner.
Exactly.
Which is a little bit different. Well,
pretty significantly.
Pretty
different,
significantly
frankly.
Differently.
Thank you.
Okay, guys.
I just wanted to clarify that point for
thank
all
you.
Of us.
Thank
for
you.
For myself.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next witness, please. I think one more. Is
one,
that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. Patty O'Sullivan, please.
Not historical.
What?
Not
good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We represent 62 hospitals in Oregon, which is all of the hospitals and their health systems. We have a hard time on this bill. When we first looked at it and when we first thought about it, we had hospitals all over the place on it. We have hospitals that already allow all this. We have hospitals that allow part of it. And we have hospitals that said, no way. And so when you're herding cats, it's really hard to get to a position, but we're almost there. So yesterday, in a hot, sweaty phone booth, I was on the phone with what we call our policy committee in the association, and it has all CEOs and folks from hospitals on it. And we debated this bill, and we went back and forth and around and around, and we came to some conclusions. I immediately went up to Representative Kenny Geyer's office and said, I think we can get there, but we have to have some parameters. And the parameters speak to exactly what Representative Buehler said, and that is, if you're going to be a member of the medical staff, you got to be a member of the medical staff. You have to take the good with the bad. You got to take the on-call was one of the things we talked about. You have to you do get, if the hospital privileges nurse practitioner midwives, it does, this bill does not mandate that they do, but if they do, then they have to allow them admitting rights without a cosigner. They have to allow them to be on the medical staff with voting rights. And the third one was some different appeals it was a set out here in the bill appeal rights. They voted, I'll tell you right now, they voted no on that. Because if you're going to be on the medical staff, you're going to have the same appeal rights as the medical staff. You're not going to have different appeal rights. Do you want to be treated differently or do you want to be treated the same? So we're saying if you're going to be treated as a medical staff, you're going to be treated the same, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I have some, I'm drawing up some amendments over the weekend. I have a meeting on Monday with Representative Kenny Geyer's staff and the proponents of the bill, and we are hoping to come to yes. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Oh, and Representative Greenlick, you asked a question, and you asked if it would change the number of births in a hospital, the level of how many births are by a nurse practitioner in a hospital. I don't at this point believe it will, because if a hospital already privileges them to birth.
Question.
Oh, well, what was your question?
My question was, how did it happen if they didn't have hospital privileges now?
It would.
And the answer was co-signing with.
Yeah, it's co-signing, and just to clarify that. There's occasion when a doctor might be under under some sort of a disciplinary measure for something, where for a while, a year, whatever, they may have to have a cosigner for admitting, and this would be no different for the nurse practitioner midwives. Everything that could happen and does happen to doctors will happen to them. So that was one thing that they were very clear about, that it's got to be equal, not special.
Doesn't seem to be a problem, so I hope you work with that. Yes,
okay. One comment, one question. I think that there may be as many births at hospitals as there are now, but some people may be able to go to a hospital that's closer by. In the instance of Monica Arce, if she, you know, doesn't have admitting privilege, she wants to see deliver the baby she's been taking care of, and if she can't be at OH, if she doesn't have it at her closer hospital and has to send them out to OHSU. They are delivering in a hospital, but it's much farther away, which could compromise the safety. That's the comment. The question is, on the appeals process, I thought that part of the appeals was for appealing whether you aren't accepted. So are you saying that that should also be
for privileging?
The same? Right. What? Not just once you're on medical staff, but even before that.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. I mean, there are doctors, there are obstetricians that are not accepted for privileging now,
and
whatever appeal rights they have would also follow suit with nurse practitioner midwives.
Thank you. Just want to make that clarification of before they're on a medical staff versus the rights they have as a medical staff member. So
correct.
Good. I look forward to that conversation.
You guys can have further conversation.
Do we have one more comment from somebody who testified? Can they?
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, I do think it's an important distinction to make Sarah Wickenhagen, again, from the Board of Nursing, that there are hospitals who do not offer this ability. So Ashland would be an example, where we have nurse midwives who would like to have privileges and currently don't. And so, therefore, they don't have babies in the hospital because they aren't able to have their patients transfer there unless they go through the emergency room and then receive OB care from a physician that they've never met. So I think that's an important distinction that the committee should understand is currently happening.
All right.
And Chair Greenlick, we understand that. This does not require a hospital to privilege nurse practitioner midwives, and if it did, we would oppose the entire bill because that's up to each hospital to decide.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing and expect to hear how this is going as it progresses. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2930 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2931. What do we have here? Who's going to speak for this one?
Representative Kenny Geyer will probably step down to speak, Mr. Chair, but this requires the Oregon Health Authority to disseminate to each school district information relating to elevated radon levels. It specifies the type of information to be included, directs each school district to develop a plan for schools where the radon levels are elevated, specifies the criteria for those plans, directs the school district to submit the plan to OHA on or before September 1, 2016. This appropriates general fund monies to the authority and to the Department of Education
for any of the items identified in the bill, and this has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Does this not have a
No, Mr. Referral? Chair, we would have to add that on.
But it has money as a piece of it?
It's
it appropriates funds.
It does.
It should have a referral.
It's going to have to have a referral.
Right. It's language. There's no dollar amount specified in that appropriation, okay. Just the language that appropriates.
Hmm. Representative Kenny Geyer. Hi.
Hi. Hoping you're not sick of me. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, colleagues, Alyssa Kennegeyer, House District 46, Southeast Northeast Portland, and I'm hoping to be joined here pretty soon by Senator Dembro, who is my partner in this. We worked on this. Is he here?
She called.
Yeah. Yay! I'm so happy.
Where was this the puff of smoke?
This is a lot sooner than I had told him. I thought it would come on our agenda because you're being so efficient. Unlike I as a chair, and getting things through your committee. But it's been an honor to work with Senator Dembro on this, and we've been at this for about a year and a half. Let him speak a little more to the process. I just want to read a few things that I have that are being passed out to you now for the record. EPA ranks indoor radon as one of the most serious environmental health problems facing us today. After smoking, it is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States and the highest leading cause of lung cancer among non-smokers. According to the EPA, prolonged indoor radon exposure causes an estimated 21,000, I'm not sure, I'll have to get back to you on that, lung cancer deaths a year. This, in fact, is more than drunk driving, which has a lot of attention, and yet this is a disease that not very many people know about. That is because it's a natural occurring gas that seeps into buildings from the surrounding soil, but we cannot see, taste, or smell radon. In fact, the only way to discover if high levels of radon are present is through testing. EPA recommends that schools be tested periodically. They're not firm in how long that is, but usually they suggest 10 years. Since they are places where children, teachers, and other school personnel spend hours each day. Since radon levels can vary within short distances, EPA recommends the testing of all frequently used rooms on and below the ground level. Some school districts in Oregon have been aggressive in testing their buildings, such as ours, Portland Public Schools, but not all of them have been able to do so, even though the test kits are inexpensive, $4 per room, when purchased in bulk. Because some schools may not have tested due to cost, and because we all have an interest in making sure that children are not exposed to this health hazard, HB 2931 requires Oregon Health Authority to provide the cost of the actual test kits and training in how to do the testing. We encourage districts to mitigate rooms that show excessive radon, but this bill does not require them to do so. If the schools do, it will be at the district expense unless the state in the future sees a compelling need to support mitigation. If the school chooses to mitigate, Oregon Health Authority will provide follow-up test kits to ensure that the mitigation has been successful. The goal of this bill is to keep the process as simple and inexpensive as possible for the districts while allowing them to benefit from the expertise and oversight of OHA. And I'll say that we're not trying to do it all in the next 2 years. We're trying to have all schools that have not been tested within the last 10 years to be tested over the next 5 years.
Senator,
I'll turn it over.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, House colleagues. It's great to see you. I think that Representative Kenny Geyer has really explained the need for this and given you a sense of what the bill does. This actually came out of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee last year when I was chairing it. It was a committee bill. And we had a good hearing, and we actually were at a point where we could there was interest in supporting it. We could move it through the process, but we ran into fiscal issues around how much this would cost and just the indeterminacy of, so how many rooms are we talking about? What kind of schedule would it be? We started meeting with the Oregon School Boards Association, and I will say that people in the education world are broadly supportive of what we're trying to accomplish here. But we felt that it was necessary to use the interim to really, look at the bill, see how we could simplify it, and get a better sense of, so what is the potential impact going to be on the health authority in terms of how many rooms would need to be tested. And so what we have tried to do in this bill is to come up with a process, you know, that's simple, that is, you know, it is staged over time to keep the burden down, where there can be a state role in terms of providing advice to school districts on how they do this, you know, what the EPA standards are, and how they can stay in conformity with those standards, and, you know, just really be a resource for them. So that's what we've tried to do here. I think we've, you know, we've had very useful meetings with school personnel around this. And I think we have eliminated any the elements of it that gave them the heebie-jeebies, if I can use that term.
Senator, I remember doing a radon test in my basement, and it was hanging something up and send it off somewhere. Why can't this just be a part of routine maintenance in a school? I mean, it isn't all that complicated.
We agree, and we have some technical specialists who can come up and speak to that. Okay. I think schools are more fearful than they probably need to be, just because some of them haven't done it before. I've done that in my home, too. It's a very easy test.
It is, but if I could follow up, just thinking from their perspective, you know, if Alyssa mishangs her test, she's not subject to a lawsuit from her husband, right? Probably.
Hopefully. I think.
We're going to find out.
Schools are concerned about their exposure, you know, if this is not done correctly. I would say
just
that's
the way
a
everything
concern.
Else that goes on in school is done perfectly.
It's, you know, the other thing is, you know, we all recognize that, you know, with budget cuts and certainly in very small districts, staff are, you know, called upon to do a lot of things and often to fulfill multiple roles. And so there's concern about the workload elements. And so that's why, you know, rather than, you know, each personnel have to do the research of what it takes, et cetera, we want to make this as simple as possible. Hence the role of the health authority in helping with that.
And we didn't also anticipate a one-size-fits-all, so the first part of the bill is for them to come up with a plan of how they plan to work with Oregon Health Authority, because you could have everything from Oregon Health Authority or county health people coming out and doing it, or training facilities people, or when the facilities people from all the districts get together, they could go through a training. There's many ways in which this could get done, and rural areas may look very different from urban areas, and so the idea is, let the districts with OHA come up with a plan about how they're going to test, and that'll be the first part of it. And then the testing will have to happen sometime between that and a five-year period.
Unless you have any questions, we get somebody who knows something. Up here.
Well, Representative Lively, you know.
Yes.
Can I ask? So, I appreciate this information, but so here's my confusion. In the first part, it talks about prolonged indoor exposure and the number of deaths from lung cancer, and then later it talks about only every 10 years. So am I to assume that prolonged exposure is much longer than 10 years, if indeed the expectation is we're only going to test every 10 years?
So prolonged exposure to radon is what can cause the lung cancer.
I understand that.
The idea of doing all of the schools within the next 5 years, and then every 10 years you want it. Once you
Reacher.
Have cleared them, then it's unlikely it's going to change. There are several things, and this will be part of OHA's training. There are several things within a 10-year period that can change it. If all of a sudden cracks develop, because cracks in the floor, there may be things that come up like that are missed, but they can tell them what kinds of things to look out for. If the HVAC system has changed or there's significant remodeling and you change the umbrella, I think it's called, of the building, those kind of things can be changed too. We actually do have that in the current version of the bill, but we're going to take out any mention of HVAC, because while that is the best science, we decided that rather than mandate that starts making the fiscal very hard to determine. Right now you can say how many schools out there have not been tested in the last 10 years, and all the remaining ones are a part of this. Once you start saying, well, and in addition to that, how many have changed their HVAC systems, and how many have gone through significant remodels, and does that significant remodel qualify you for this? It gets very confusing, so we just decided to take that out and put that in the educational training piece of what Oregon Health Authority would do. So if they've been tested over a 10-year period, they will start knowing what to look for as possible signs of radon seeping back in after clearance.
Okay, let's call the next panel. Thank you for coming
on.
Thank you.
Do you want them all together?
Sure.
Rushing back.
Lori Satinspiel, Otto Schell, Steve Tucker. That is it, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself as you begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm glad to be here. To better not outside. It's Friday. I'll be brief.
Get done quickly.
Get done quickly. Yeah, I just wanted to say I am so grateful that there's a bill in front of me that I can support today. It's been a rough go so far for me with the bills I have to follow. I think Senator Dembrough and Representative Kenny Guyer have done a great job of outlining the bill and the process. They mentioned district landscape is all over the map, from the small rural who don't think they have radon to the other end of the spectrum. Portland Public is testing. Salem Kaiser is here in the audience as well, and they're testing. Beaverton, I just passed out their letter. They've started testing. They were kind of on hold from 2014 under House Bill 1511. They were worried about starting out and then having some law change and the testing of the process they were going through. So we're really all over the map. Districts want to be sure that they test properly. So the confusion about the kit versus having certified testers, and you'll hear from Steve about that. You know, what's the right result? There's discussion about testing what time of year. You know, all the doors and windows need to be closed, but there's students coming and going. So all sorts of interesting challenges with testing schools. We want to be sure staff and students are kept safe, so it is a priority for something to get underway. And so agreeing to the stages, let's get things started. So districts who don't have a plan or don't know how to get started, OHA can help them with a model plan, from the Portland Publics, the Salem Kaisers, and the Beavertons, who already have a plan that they're going to work with, submit it to OHA to just say, hey, what are we missing? We can put testing timelines and all sorts of things in those plans. So we're here today to support. I will say we have a dash one, and I hope the committee's seen that. There was a piece, and I think Representative Kenny Guyer mentioned it, about the HVAC system or envelope and a $50,000 threshold, and we decided to get that out and just go with testing, getting started with plans, and doing what we can to start out with. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
We haven't had a witness yet who said, here's my testimony, and I do not want to answer any of your questions. But that will come one of these
days. We have that on the floor.
That's a different question. Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick. I'm Otto Schell. I'm with the Oregon PTA. I'm happy to say that with Lori's company, we participated throughout this process and very much appreciated the leadership of Senator Dembrough and Representative Kenny Guyer. This is an issue that's been on the radar of PTAs at the national level since the 1990s. They were participant in national discussions about indoor air quality and radon with the Lung Association and EPA. There has been some work done on that, but this is an issue that's been on our radar for a while. We support the plan as it's laid out in HB 2931. We think getting started is a critical piece. We learned in our various conversations about the unevenness of the data in various places. And where I live in North and Northeast Portland, we have a lot of research about the frequency of radon. The absence of information in many places is also troubling, and we think that getting started with the plan, this will reveal if there's a problem, how we can deal with the problem. And it's a smart way to kind of ramp up and do the work. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Steve Tucker. I represent myself. I've been a certified radon specialist, testing and mitigation, for about 25 years or so.
I've been involved with national radon standards. I've also been involved when the Oregon State Codes Division had a work group to establish radon-resistant codes for new building construction. I was asked to be involved in that, and I'm basically here to, in support of the bill, and then to answer any technical questions you might have.
Great.
Thank you.
Are there questions at this panel?
Yeah, I have one.
Yes.
Quick question. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Could you talk about maybe the next step, mitigation, and what that process will be? I know some places have certified mitigators for this, some don't. What now that we, if we collect the information, what are we going to do with it, and where does that lead us as far as how much time does it take to mitigate, you know, to get a school to a level that we need? Can you talk to that process a little bit? Sure. Well, anybody.
Sure. I'll start an answer to that. Schools typically, well, they range. There is no typical school. They range from everything from a small, country school to a large facility like West Salem High. On average, the vast majority of the time, radon levels can be reduced in a school facility by simply adjusting HVAC by dilution. That's something that can be done in-house. It doesn't need someone like myself to come in. Same thing is true.
It changes the flow. Is that the
I'm sorry?
It changes the flow.
Radon is the influx of radon into a building is driven typically by pressure differentials, airflow as well, and dilution, fresh air versus, not. In very rare cases, do you get a really large portion of a school facility that needs to be addressed. Most of the time, it's either via adjusting the HVAC or it's a very focused solution. A good example is the work we've done at West Salem High, where basically the whole school tested, I assume maybe someone's here from there, but it tested low, save for a couple of rooms. And I believe at least one of those rooms was addressed by adjusting the HVAC. The other room was addressed with a standalone radon system, just a singular system. It what I would call reasonable cost. And so as far as there's no way without testing to tell what the extent of the mitigation needed would be, either statewide or, in a singular facility. Until the testing's done, there's just not enough information to do that. But the bottom line is the vast, vast majority of the time, the fix is simple, very straightforward. And there's no reason that facility staff maybe could do that. The industry standard says that at least the work and the testing be have oversight by someone who's certified or in the field. There is no licensing in the state of Oregon right now for somebody in my field. But there are national standards set and EPA standards that have been in place for quite some time. So my recommendation is that health authority be involved, perfect neutral. I mean, I can be construed as biased. It's my business. But you get the health authority involved, showing facility people how to do the test, help them, and maybe also help them know and be educated how to tweak the HVAC in a system. And maybe in the more rare cases, hopefully the rare cases, something has to be done a little more actively, so to speak, as far as a standalone mitigation system, but only in focused parts of the building. So I hope that answers
you. Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, from the district's perspective on the next steps, the model plan will help us start looking at, are we going to be remodeling? Are we going to be building? We need to now start calculating radon testing into this as the next step. And then, of course, if something is found, how do we mitigate? So whatever those costs are. And I think that was part of the discussion that the group had is what would trigger more testing. So, and that's why I think the plan, it can be written into the plan what the district is going to do on the next phase. Give districts that want to have the option to have professional development for a facility person to be able to monitor and run the test, help do that. That all feeds into budget and being able to keep a safe environment.
Yeah.
Can I add something there?
Yes, please.
Also, several years ago, we passed legislation out of here that was the Cool Schools, mm-hmm. which is to increasing energy conservation in the schools. And then we also made bonding available for seismic upgrades. Both of those are situations that we want to make sure as people are doing those kind of remodeling. Of course, if you're working with the foundation to increase the seismic safety, then that is a perfect time to be making sure that you look, you know, why be thinking about this later after you've just shored up your foundation? Because you can integrate that at a much lower cost. And then on the conservation, that can actually make radon worse. And so it's really important that as we go through some of those efforts that we have more awareness among our staff. Now, a lot of architects and engineers are aware of this. Hopefully they would be. But we want to make sure it's on the radar of the school staff, too.
Can I just say one more thing about radon?
Very briefly, please.
Yes. As opposed to other air quality concerns like benzene, maybe you've read things about that lately in the paper and in the media, radon's correctable. You can actually do something about it.
Locally,
yes. Thank you. Well
played. And, Chair, I do think that we have someone from OHA if you have any other technical questions.
No,
you don't need to.
Any. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2931 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2600. What do we have on that, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2600 requires the continuation of the group health insurance coverage for an employee that is on family leave. And we have Representative Barbara Smith Warner and Andrea Peluso.
And one more witness after this, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, correct, Mr. Chair.
What do we have? It's still, okay, we have it. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner. I am a House representative from District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I am here today to speak briefly to you on a bill that has three great things going for it. Number one, it's a really good idea. Number two, it's quite simple. And number three, it's co-sponsored by three of the seven people that are sitting on that dais. So I'm particularly excited to talk to you about it.
Only need two more votes to get on.
I know. You know, it's like starting out on third and thinking you hit a triple. Okay. So House Bill 2600, as you heard in the summary. So basically, right now, under current Oregon law, if you take Oregon, well, and I apologize for using acronyms, but we talk about OFLA and FEMLA. And OFLA is Oregon Family Medical Leave Act, and FEMLA is the Family Medical Leave Act. It's the federal level. So right now, under the Oregon version of Family Medical Leave, you could lose your insurance, your group insurance that you have while you are out taking family leave, which just seems wrong on a number of bases, fairness being the biggest one. Now, the good news is that Oregon's regulations maintain it. So, Oregon's regulations say you can lose it. Federal regulations say that you maintain it. So what this bill does is basically brings Oregon law into alignment with the federal standard and protects continuation of group health insurance coverage when an employee is on OFLA, or Oregon Federal Leave Act. So another great thing about this bill is that it came from an AOI-requested work group to explore the differences in the two laws between the Oregon Federal Leave and the National Federal Leave. Oregon Federal Leave covers companies with 25 or more employees, while FEMLA covers those with 50 or more. So this bill will close that gap and ensure that all companies with 25 or more employees continue group health coverage. It will continue that group health coverage for the individual, their covered family members, and require the employees to continue contributing to their health premiums. And that is it. I'm happy to take any questions or defer them to my co-presenter.
Here.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2600 today. We support ensuring that no employee covered by the Oregon Family Leave Act, OFLA, will face a loss of health insurance when they are on protected medical leave. We see this, as Representative said, as a technical fix in Oregon's law and is a provision that's already included in the Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA. Oregon has been a strong leader with regards to making access to Oregon to family leave available to employees. Our laws in Oregon predate federal laws, and in fact, some could argue we're part of the impetus for some of our federal laws. In addition, in areas where there's been a difference between the state and federal law, Oregon has made a conscious decision repeatedly to provide more protections than is found in federal law, like including protections for sick child leave and covering additional employers and also expanding definitions of family. Some of the primary differences, as Representative Smith Warner mentioned, are around employer size. There are some additional reasons for leave that are protected under OFLA that are not protected under FMLA, and again, some additional family members. So there are a few differences. One major discrepancy where the federal law is more expansive is this issue where an employer will maintain an employee's health insurance benefits while on leave. The OFLA law, again, does not require that. We would argue that this is the most important time for an employee to be able to maintain their health insurance benefits. They're usually on leave due to a serious health condition as is required by that law, and or caring for a family member with a serious health condition. And again, if the employer offers family health insurance benefits, those would again need to be maintained. So again, as was mentioned, we see this as a fairly simple technical fix. It is just aligning the state law to existing standards around what is required already under FMLA, and we encourage you to support this. Thank you.
Any questions, panel?
A quick question. Yep. It's just a clarification.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll only take questions from my co-sponsors.
Yes. Okay.
Ouch.
You can sign up.
You can remedy that.
You want to take your name off or whatever.
Chair Greenlick, thank you. So as an employer, I've worked with this a lot. People go on Family Leave Act, Maternity Leave, or whatever, and it is a problem. It's always a problem. What do you do with the medical insurance? but even as an employer that would continue to pay that benefit, you know, optionally, discretionary benefit for us, oftentimes the employee, if there was, it was even a small copay that they paid regularly, and it says in here that you continue your regular plan. Yeah. If they can't afford to do that, what happens month two? Because if that payment doesn't get paid, then that insurance gets canceled, but the employer was continuing to make their share. Mm-hmm. So how do you address that?
We can check on what happens around that now with regards to FMLA, because again, most employers that are covered under OFLA are also, and most reasons for leave are also covered under FMLA leave. So we can check to see, but it's fairly clearly spelled out in the bill that the employee is supposed to maintain their contribution as well. So it should not be the onus of the employer, and I think with the spirit of this bill, if the employee is not making their contribution as well.
I actually think I know the answer.
Your own question?
No, to
his question.
So in my experience, when you have a small employer and they go on family medical leave, it just basically the employer waits and bills them when they come back, and when there's income to, you know, when they come back to work, they just carry it, frankly, and then they charge it against their premium when they come back to work.
Thank you, but I wasn't asking what typically happens. I was asking what this bill addresses.
Well, but I mean, because right now, if you, under the current situation, if your premium's not covered, how do I want to say this? Okay, you're an employer with a large group, 50 or more, covered under FMLA, and your employer's paying your benefit, but you have premium share. Usually, that employer just waits for you to come back to work because there's no income to draw from, right?
Right.
So it would be the same thing, I believe, under this.
It would be the employee's obligation to pay that.
But the employer would probably wait until that employee came back to work because you're not drawing a paycheck.
The bill doesn't require that.
I think the answer to the question is the employer would continue to pay that.
Right.
even if the employee didn't pay their share. Hey, it's the only way it could possibly work.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. If it could be canceled because the employee couldn't pay a small copay.
Well, because it's already being paid by the employer, and the employer is getting it back from the employee.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from Betsy Earle next, please.
I can't get it back from the employee if there's no payment.
Representative, you might hang in.
They'll ever get it back.
In case I have questions or whatever.
We just like having you here.
I like being here.
Hi there.
Hello.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And a couple comments before I begin. I think it is a wonderful thing that AOI requested a work group on the differences between federal and state family leave laws in Oregon. And as I understand it, it was a fairly productive experience. But I would like to be clear that AOI did not request this bill, and AOI actually opposes House Bill 2600. For a number of reasons, and I'm sure you're all surprised by that.
No.
No. I did hear this bill described as something that people view as a technical fix, and with all due respect, I would say that it's only a technical fix if you're not the person or the company that's having to pay the bill while your employees are off on family leave. And, you know, generally speaking, family leave is not a picnic. People are off on family leave always for excellent reasons. Nevertheless, the employer is paying for that health insurance while they're also, you know, having to find another person probably to take up the work of the employee that's on leave and cover all of those other expenses. So as it's been pointed out, the current federal law already requires employers to continue their payments on health insurance premiums. But there are a couple of big differences. Obviously, the federal law only goes for 12 weeks, and state law can go up to 36 weeks. So, you know, there are two big hits. One, if you're a large employer that's covered by both OFLA and FEMLA, you'll be paying for, under this bill, you'd be paying for your health insurance coverage premiums for 6 more months, potentially, depending on what your employee is out for, than you would be under the federal law. The other big difference is that if you are a smaller employee that's covered only by the state family leave law, you haven't had this requirement at all before, and so you'll be paying premiums while your employees are gone, which you've never done at all before. You don't do that for the first 3 months. You don't do it at all right now. When we originally put the family leave law, Oregon family leave law, together, and frankly, I can't believe that I was here when we did that, but I was. We talked about this piece quite a bit, actually, and the decision was made at that time to leave it to an agreement between employees and employers, or to be the policy of the employer, with the recognition that it would probably benefit the employer, and they would recognize that, to go ahead and continue paying for the premiums on the same basis they had been while the employee was working. At the point that we put that law together, though, there was not the extensive leave that's available in Oregon now. We weren't up to, you know, a potential 36 weeks like we are now. So it was something that employers probably were more able to do at that time than I think that they would be now. As I pointed out, we are potentially extending an employer's obligation to pay health insurance premiums for an additional 6 months or for the full 36 weeks. And we have many, many members who are paying between 75 and 100% of the full premium for their employee or for the employee's family. So depending on the employee's status as a union member, whether they're exempt or non-exempt, and several other factors. So frequently, you know, in round numbers, you're looking at between $800 and $1,000 per month. I know my own employer pays north of that per person or family that's on leave. And if you're looking at another 6 months, you know, you're looking at another $6,000 or potentially just for one employee being on leave. And if you're an employer that's covered by Oregon Family Leave, you've got 25 employees at least, which means you're likely to have more than one person out on leave per year. So I would just point out that this bill is something that will cost a fair amount of money for employers, and it's not a decision that I think we should be describing or thinking of in terms of a technical fix, because it will be very costly for our members.
Are there any questions of Mr. Earle?
Yes.
Representative Bueller.
Thanks, Chair Greenlick. Do you know of any other states that would have a similar policy if this was passed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I do know that our neighbor to the north and south have it in Wisconsin. There are some differences, though. California's family leave and Washington's family leave cover employers with 50 or more employees, and both of them have shorter amounts of leave that can be accrued than Oregon.
So none that have potentially nine or 36 weeks?
Not to my knowledge, but it was a quick internet search. Wisconsin also has such a law, but I think Wisconsin might also be at 50 employees.
Okay.
I don't think that there is any other state that has as much as 36 weeks.
Kenny Geyer.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
I have a question. If you could explain the 6 months, how that happens, and also how often that happens here, where people draw upon past the 12 weeks that they're offered under the OFLA?
I haven't boned up carefully on my family leaves that people are eligible for, but my understanding is that you can take leave for, you know, kind of the general reasons of a family illness or your own serious health condition or a child's, you know, less serious health condition, which is a couple 3-day leave. There's leave having to do with military deployment and military caregiving leave. And there is a fair amount of leave that is possible for pregnancy disability, which is something that Washington and California both allow, but in lesser amounts.
And the 6 months is the difference between the federal program, which is 3 months, and the state program, which is 9 months. Is that
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
And so follow up, do you know how often people tap into it at different times in a year? I've heard that's very rare. Do you have any numbers on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer, honestly, I do not.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one of the advocates that might have more information about that?
Let's hold that, because we have another bill to hear.
I'm sorry.
And another witness is asked to testify. So why don't we call Tricia Smith up for very brief comments, and then we'll move to the next bill.
May I request that she be able to submit that to the committee, her responses to Representative
Absolutely.
Kenny Geyer's? Great, thank
I'll
you.
I'll ask my employer members too.
Thank you.
We'll have some more if we go to work session.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I'm here in strong support of House Bill 2600. And my message is I had the pleasure of crafting the family leave bill. And we would have included this language in the original bill had it ever occurred to us that an employer would cancel health insurance when someone is out facing a serious medical emergency or illness. So we would have included it in the first place had it occurred to us. Since it didn't occur to us, and now we have examples of it, I strongly urge you to include it in the law now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, if there is more information to come to us, it would be very helpful if
you
organize that. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2600 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2934. Remind the witnesses on this that we have about 20 minutes for this bill. Mr. Mullen could take up that time all by himself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and with me will be other members of the Inclusion Affordability Innovation Coalition. And I want to talk a little bit about why we are here today. We're here today in support of House Bill 2934, which would direct the Oregon Health Authority to submit a blueprint of how Oregon would implement a basic health plan for the state of Oregon. And please note, this is not a bill to implement the basic health plan. This is a matter of getting a review from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, We would hope to have some feedback back in time for the 2016 session, so you would have an opportunity to take a look at the review from CMS. We also are envision a stakeholder group that would get together with the Oregon Health Authority to talk about the best ways to frame a blueprint. Oregon Health Authority has been really very helpful and cooperative all throughout this process. I want to just, for newer members, just give a very quick context to what we've been about and how long this discussion's been going on. When I look back at my testimony, I was first before your committee, Mr. Chair, back in 2012. We had subsequent discussions during the 13th session. It led to a pretty much an all-day session that we had with you and your counterpart on the Senate side, and also Representative Kenny Guyer participated in that, where we heard from experts at the national level about how a basic health plan could work. We came back to the 2014 session and asked for some funding to fund a study to take a look at how basic health would specifically work for the state of Oregon. We were pleased that the legislature allowed that to happen. We had a very good stakeholder group discussion with the Oregon Health Authority and with our consultants, came back with a report. Prior to that report coming out, we had noted in our testimony that we had no preconceived notion about whether basic health is the right approach for the state of Oregon. After seeing the report, we are here to say that we do think that basic health is right for the state of Oregon, but we're interested in being deliberative and taking this a step at a time. So I just want to just mention very quickly, because there are some people on the panel that will fill in some information about basic health if you have questions, but I would just say that we have our one-pager that should be on OLIS shows the breadth and depth of our support. It's all of us up here in the organizations we represent. 13 in all total have endorsed this, ranging alphabetically from AARP of Oregon to SEIU. So basically what we are here today to do is to ask for your support in moving the bill forward and so that we can have further discussion about basic health and look at the right way to do it for the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
The OHA in the past has said this can be handled within their budget. You expect they're going to say the same thing on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I expect that would be the case. The Oregon Health Authority has a number of really qualified staff that routinely work with CMS on waiver issues. So, yes, I would expect they can do it within their budget.
We'll see. We haven't asked for fiscal. Great. Hi.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. OCPP is participating in the Inclusion, Affordability, Innovation Coalition that John mentioned. I want to first thank the legislature for your great work on health reform. Of course, there's been great news about coverage in Oregon. Upwards of 95% of Oregonians now have coverage. That's a huge accomplishment. Our work is not done, though. There are approximately 120,000 Oregonians who are eligible for marketplace coverage but who are not insured. And the majority of those individuals make too much to afford Medicaid, but they don't have it in their budgets to purchase the marketplace plans, even with the generous subsidies. There is information, should be on OLIS for you, about this topic. We put out a fact sheet last year called Uninsured Despite the Mandate. But basic health offers a way forward on this issue. It's a potential win-win for Oregon families, for providers, and for Oregon, and for the state's budget. So a little bit about how basic health would work. Basic health is an option under the Affordable Care Act for states to offer coverage to low-income adults who do not get coverage through through their employer and are not eligible for Medicaid. Instead of shopping in the exchange, the state would offer coverage, and it would typically offer coverage through a basic health program, and it would be at lower cost to them than typically in the marketplace. About funding, the state would receive funds from the federal government to operate the program. Those funds would come from the subsidies that the federal government would otherwise be directing to the marketplace in Oregon to subsidize coverage. So I want to tell you that, as John mentioned, there you did authorize a study, and there were significant great information that resulted from that study, and I'll just briefly summarize the key points. First of all, the low-income individuals eligible for exchange coverage who would be uninsured would drop from 17% to about 17% to about 5.8%, and that's a significant drop amongst struggling households. Secondly, if they were offered an Oregon Health Plan benefit package, they would gain access to important services that they currently typically don't have in the exchange, one of the most important being adult dental services. In addition, low-income households would likely see their costs, out-of-pocket costs, go down. The study showed that out-of-pocket costs for families could decline up to $1,600 a year, depending on how Oregon structured the program. Other benefits could be the potential for boosting provider payments under the Oregon Health Plan and reducing administrative costs that happen when individuals switch frequently between the Oregon Health Plan and marketplace coverage due to changes in income, and that's a phenomenon typically we call churn. Rates of churn could go down significantly depending on how it was structured. Additional good news is that the marketplace would remain stable despite having somewhat fewer customers, and that Oregon could operate the program within the amount of monies that it would get from the federal government, depending on how it was structured again. There would be, basic health would create.
I understand.
Seems to me, as I remember the plan, if we ran it the way that it might make some sense, it might be about $60 million a biennium. Am I misremembering the?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Medicare, the Medicaid plus.
One important thing to keep in mind is the report also mentioned that there were potential for significant savings in the Cowan program for people who are have need emergency care and they're not documented, and also for pregnant women that are currently covered up to 185% of the poverty level. They did not have the ability to calculate those savings because that was Oregon specific. So,
but it didn't assert that it would be covered without additional cost to Oregon. If we use the assumption you mentioned that we used Oregon Health Plan benefit.
Mr. Chair, the study outlined a scenario where much of the cost, if not all the cost, for the program could be covered should Oregon make a number of additional policy changes that are sort of would be logical. One of those would be the option of charging modest premiums for some individuals in the program, and that there would be a number of budgetary savings that were not calculated that they advise, well, that they say could generate savings that would result in a potential break even or generating a modest surplus.
I must have read a different report.
Okay. Yeah, it seems.
Incidentally, I would recommend you all read that report. It's a very interesting report.
Right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. So the bottom line is that how this would work really depends on the design of the program. There's many choices that Oregon would have, and that's why we're at the point of looking at House Bill 2934, which would have us roll up our sleeves, and the Oregon Health Authority would work with all stakeholders in developing a program that would work, that would fit our health reform goals, and that would work well for us. So then with those details worked out, the legislature could then decide whether to go ahead and implement. So in conclusion, It's a way forward for us to continue to advance health reform in addressing challenges that we continue to face. It's a potential win-win approach, and I thank you very much for allowing me to speak with you today. Thank you.
Esteemed Chair, Vice Chairs, committee members, my name is Alberto Moreno, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I also have the privilege of serving as chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. I'm here today with my colleagues to testify in support of House Bill 2934, which would respectfully direct OHA to submit a blueprint for how Oregon would implement a basic health plan, as you've heard. The bill, from our perspective, is the next logical step in ensuring affordable access to health care for all Oregonians. We believe that a basic health plan option is good for Oregon and Oregon's workforce. Specifically, basic health plan would help extend health insurance coverage for legally present immigrants. And I want to repeat that, legally present immigrants who would otherwise qualify for Medicaid but for the fact that they are here within their first five-year bar. The immigrant community, as you know, plays an important role in our economy, and their health affects us all. Farm workers, for example, contribute over $5.3 billion to Oregon's economy each and every year. And this Latino community, over 500,000 strong, have a purchasing power of over $8 billion that they bring to our state. Unfortunately, many of these legal immigrants do not qualify for Medicare, even if they are at Medicaid incomes. By federal law, legal immigrants who have Medicaid-level incomes must wait 5 years before they can enroll. This is referred to as a five-year bar. If you earn poverty wages, as in the case of a farm worker, for example, whose annual salary is less than $10,000 a year, and you already struggle to put food on your children's table, clothe them, and pay utilities. Paying costly monthly premiums and co-pays when you visit the doctor represents a considerable hardship for these families and drives health-seeking behaviors which result in deferral of care and subsequent ER visits. Based on existing studies, costs could be much lower under basic health plan than in state exchanges. A basic health plan option in Oregon can help this vital workforce get insurance, keep their coverage, and see a doctor when they need to stay healthy. In conclusion, the Oregon Latino Health Coalition believes that submitting a blueprint is a positive next step for Oregon and makes economic sense. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the executive director of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. Today, Asian and Pacific Islanders are some of the fastest growing communities here in Oregon. And while there's definitely pockets of prosperity, some of our communities still face barriers to opportunity. There's over 220,000 Asian Pacific Islanders here in Oregon today. Our organization's been engaged with communities who experience uninsurance and the consequences and challenges of trying to sort of acquire both culturally competent and affordable health care. Through the transition to CCOs and enrollment with Cover Oregon, we've seen many positive steps that have really improved both the system and access, but still there are gaps which we hope with your help we can address. APANO supports House Bill 2934 because an Oregon basic health program has the potential to eliminate disparities in two key populations for us. who are right now excluded from OHP, our Medicaid program. These are both the five-year barred immigrants that Alberto just spoke to, as well as the COFA Pacific Islanders, who you heard about around House Bill 2522 last month. These are Pacific Islanders from the Marshall Islands, Palau, and Micronesia, who have immigrated here to the U.S. as a result of our ongoing military and economic interests in their home countries. So, like many communities, our Asian and Pacific Islander communities are very connected to our families. And really briefly, one of our values is around having our families together and keeping our families together. Asian and Pacific Islanders continue to immigrate to Oregon and the U.S. for many reasons, and they share some common reasons why. As I said last time, we are here because you were there. Oregon's largest waves of Asian and Pacific Islanders have immigrated here because of our economic and military interventions in countries in Asia and the Pacific. So as our families work to reunite with their loved ones here in Oregon or across the U.S. with their children and parents and grandparents, there are some situations where families face the hardships of poverty and job loss. This is a reality that affects all Oregonians. And yet in our communities, we face additional barriers that the basic health plan may address. As an Oregon basic health program may provide access with federal support for those who are currently ineligible. This includes an estimated 7,000 legal permanent residents and COFA Oregonians. We see this as a potential viable path to provide health care to these Oregonians with little or no impact to the state budget. We believe all Oregonians should have access, equal access to health care, and we believe that House Bill 2934 is a measured step toward both achieving that goal as well as the the triple aim. Thank you for your support and your time.
Thank you.
Can you go ahead?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have never understood the five-year bar for legal immigrants nor the COFA. So just to be clear, the federal subsidies that we get for the marketplace, the health insurance exchange, can be shifted to the basic health program and can be used for these populations. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Just to repeat.
Yes, there is an exception under the ACA that provides for the coverage of those two populations through a basic health program.
Can you repeat that?
So the question is, for some reason that I've never been able to understand, CMS, Medicaid, does not allow coverage of immigrants who are here legally for the first 5 years, it's called the five-year bar, nor for this COFA population that we heard about a couple weeks ago, the Micronesia Palau.
Was the next thing you said.
Yeah, and so my understanding is that the basic health program is an ACA option that we can use for between 138% and 200% of poverty, so it extends Medicaid right now at 138 and includes the people from 0 to 200% that are in this population. You described the farm worker making $10,000. Normally they would qualify for Medicaid. But what I want to be clear about is that federal subsidies through the basic health program can be used for this population, whereas through Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, they may not be used for those two populations.
Very good, Sam. Mm-hmm.
Just want to be clear that is our only opportunity to get federal funds to help those populations.
So, question?
Chair.
Thank you very much.
So I'm still a little confused where the funding would come from. Is it fully funded from
general? Comes from the subsidies out of the health insurance exchange.
So that means that people are getting tax credits now would not get those tax credits?
Well, they would still get them, but it wouldn't be for these people.
May I ask questions related to that?
I
think they would get
it. We have one more minute and three more witnesses, so we may want to discuss this issue a little bit at a later time. But otherwise,
Is it a net funding increase or just a shift in funds?
Yeah. Chair Greenwood, Representative Bueller, the funds for basic health would be the subsidies that the federal government would be spending in the exchange rediverted to the state to offer the
program.
Can
you answer my question? Is it a net increase or shift in funds?
A shift.
Thank you.
It would be a shift in total funds. It would be essentially budget neutral for the federal government. And so anyone who would, in that income group,
who would be in the exchange up to 200% of the federal poverty level would be covered by a basic health if Oregon were to create the program.
So you're
everybody up to that range would be covered in basic health.
If they were previously in the exchange, yes.
Okay, thank you. Would you call the next thank panel? You. I'll ask you all to be very brief since our meeting ended.
And John Booker.
Sorry. About my gun range.
That's okay. And Doug Barber.
No, somebody else.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Citizens up to 200%. It's making it easier for that one.
Good afternoon, Senator Chairman Greenlick and committee.
Don't demote me.
What?
Don't demote me to the Senate.
I'm not. I'm John Booker. I represent Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates and HCAO, which is a state group. I'm here today because I support this bill because, one, I have a personal story I just wanted to share quickly. I was in the donut hole, and I had to go through OMAP, and I can tell you when health insurance is, you have to decide between rent and health insurance, it becomes very nerve-wracking. And I am a low income, and I'm on OHP, and I'm glad to be on it. But, you know, there are times when you have to decide between rent and health insurance. And as Oregonians, I feel, you know, that's an economic situation. It affects not only our families, but the state of Oregon and how our economic viability in this state. It also represents outcomes of poor health. As Oregonians, it affects how we work, how we play, how we do things in life, and it affects our employment numbers as well. And because if people aren't healthy, they can't be productive and active in their communities. And so that's why I support this. I support it because it will improve the lives of low-income Oregonians and families and individuals. It will clean up the donut hole situation between the 138 and 200% issues. And it will get 70,000 Oregonians with health insurance out of 110,000, as was previously mentioned. It not only, I think, will save us money in the long run, but it will reduce the what I call the churn rate, which is by 29%, situations where people change incomes and they change jobs, which causes them to be in situations where they don't have health insurance or uninsured. It will provide many things like dental things, which are important for people to treat the whole person. So it will provide not only basic essential benefits and will be provided for by working with other insurers to carry the basic health plan through Cover Oregon. It also provides for hopefully legal immigrants who produce and make things for our farms and our families who make Oregon a great state to live in. And so we need to support our workers, and that's all I'll say on that. And thank you for the time for letting me speak today.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters in opposition to the Basic Health Plan. I think the Basic Health Plan has two primary problems, access and choice. First, the Basic Health Plan would take 60,000 Oregonians out of the commercial insurance market and take away their choice. One thing we know from experience is that Oregonians want choice when it comes to their health care. Some of you will remember the FEOP program, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which was subsidized commercial insurance. This was before the exchange and before Cover Oregon. Some of the families in that program had a choice for their children. They could either have the Oregon Health Plan with its richer benefit package for free, or they could pay premiums to have their children on commercial insurance. I thought for sure they would pick the Oregon Health Plan. It's not what happened. I was wrong. I mean, many of them did, but a significant number chose to pay premiums so that their children could be on commercial insurance. And these are the same low-income working Oregonians that the Basic Health Plan would cover. We saw a similar pattern a year ago when the ACA kicked in. people went through the process. They implemented their, or they input their income, and it kicks back saying you're eligible for Medicaid. Our agents reported a significant number of people coming into their offices saying, I don't want Medicaid. I want a subsidy so that I can buy commercial insurance. Mm. Oregonians want choice. And one of the reasons for that is access to care. Earlier this week, Debbie Farr from the Trillium CCO in Eugene testified that there are 13,000 people in Lane County who are on the Oregon Health Plan who do not have access to a primary care provider. What this program would do, would be take another 60,000 people and put them into that system. Lane County has about 10% of the state's population, so that's another 6,000, give or take, in Lane County who currently have insurance and access, if they can pay it, which I recognize is an issue. They'll take them from having insurance and access to having insurance without access. The Medicaid Advisory Committee last summer recommended against creating the basic health plan. They thought, one, that Oregon did not have or was not in a position to create and administer a new health plan, and they thought that access would be a problem, especially if the basic health plan was going to pay Medicare rates or Medicaid rates, which is what the proposal looking at doing. We think that the basic health plan is fine if that's what people choose, but that they should have a choice. I tried to work on an amendment that would ask Oregon to request a waiver from the federal government to allow choice within the basic health plan. Legislative Council says there's no mechanism in the law that would allow that. I have been told that there is another process, the so-called 1332 waivers. These were the ones that Senator Wyden got included in the law that begin in 2017. They give states more flexibility under the ACA. Maybe those would provide an option for a basic health plan with choice. But if we can't figure out a way to have a basic health plan with choice, we don't think we should do it at all. Thank you.
Can I address what he just said? One of the things that it will do, sir, is you wouldn't keep your own doctors. There would not be are concerned about is when people lose health care coverage, they lose their doctors, and they have to start the process all over again to find a new physician. And I can tell you, personal experience-wise, that can be a very tough thing to go look for a new doctor. So this would not interrupt it would keep the consistent coverage, so if people lost their job or something happens in their life, they would be able to have the basic health things of what basically OHP covers with the dental and whatnot. So that, and addressing the access issue there, and also the fact that the other thing it addresses is that people will still be able to get more expensive insurance if they can afford it. So it's not going to stop people from getting, if they choose to have that. You won't be able to have both OHP and...
We need to close.
Yeah. And basic health or regular insurance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2934 and wish you all a happy weekend in the sun.
We're adjourned.
Happy weekend in the sun.
We're adjourned.